Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session.
Welcome back to Fright School.
Joshua, is that you?
It seems like it's been so long since I've seen you.
I know. Well, I mean, we have been here the whole time, right?
Right, of course.
You know, the illusion.
Right.
So I've maintained the illusion.
No, it's so funny. That's how, like, production, when you get ahead of schedule, it's, like, so weird.
I got sick.
That's true. You did get
ill. I fell victim.
I know.
Got afflicted with homosexuality.
Well, I mean,
there's no cure.
With the way things are going, that may, again, you know, we might just add it back to the DSM and,
oh, Lord,
they'll arrest us and, you know, murder us. I don't know. I'm not sure what's happening.
I mean, there is a podcast that takes place in a prison. So if there's one, there can be two. But we might not go to the same prison.
It's true. We might not. We'd have to, like, actually figure out how to. What do you call that?
Like, how to, like, remotely record.
Remotely record, yes.
Do you exactly. think that the prison will have Zencaster?
I don't know. Well, this
oh,
is
dear.
Very strange how,
yes.
how we've gotten where we are. Anyways, it is good to see you, Joe.
My name is Joe. You're Joshua, are you? Did you forget my name?
I don't know what just happened. My brain.
Say my name, Joshua.
Anyways, it is good to see you again, and I'm glad that you're feeling better and that you don't sound like there's glass all shoved up in your throat.
Glass all up in my throat and all in my nose and, well, not glass, but, like, you know,
yeah.
other things.
Terrible. Terrible, terrible. But anyways, we are back, and it's so nice to be back
yeah.
here. So let's see. We just got a
back in the physical location of the West Craven Memorial Library.
I know it feels like we haven't recorded in here in quite a bit.
I know you've changed things.
I have. I'm doing a massive.
What are you doing?
Yeah, I know. I'm changing some stuff. I'm doing an editing on my books. I'm trying because Kindle like has so much stuff free. Or like, especially like classic literature or things that are no longer or that are like in the public domain. I'm trying to edit books that I don't really necessarily need, to make room for other books.
the real books that you want.
The books that I need. Yeah. So I've been editing out a lot of stuff. Also over the years, I mean, a lot of these books I've had almost, you know, my entire adult life, but even some of them I've had since I was a teenager. So some of them are losing significance to me.
Ah, yes.
You know how that happens, where it's like, I think, oh, I want to keep this book till I die. And now I'm like, I don't know why I thought I'd want to read this
I see
again.
A well-worn copy of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
No, you do not see that.
A well-worn copy of The Giving Tree.
Right. Actually, I'm surprised I don't have that. I do enjoy Shel Silverstein.
Yes. Silverstein?
Is it Silverstein?
I don't know.
I always thought it was Shel Silverstein.
Well, no, Frankenstein.
Oh, right. Very good. Joe, sorry.
Keep
up. As you can see, my brain, I am also moving as slowly as the Frankenstein's monster, but we'll discuss that in the second half of this episode. But yeah, so anyways, I'm just going through trimming some things down. I took out, I moved a lot of the music stuff to the front room where, I mean, I never...
The music room.
No, not the music room, but to the actual, like, the living room.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like concert films and things, stuff that I'm going to want to watch out there. So
exactly. So stuff that out, is you, better not, better to not collect dust.
Exactly. But if you see, I took out a whole section of the case there, dropped it down.
Wow, you did.
Yeah, because I'm going to move that Elvira painting over there. This is so great for the listener
right now.
I know, right
this is podcasting is a visual medium, you know.
Anyways, the point is, yes, it's in transition because I just have to find more room for stuff. That's the problem. I've got a lot of things sitting waiting to be framed that I want to get up on the walls, so I need to edit out. I have a ton of CDs. I don't know why I have most of them. I need to just get rid of them because I haven't put a CD in a player in I don't even know how long.
Yet you've put a record in a record player.
Yes, I do listen to a lot of vinyl because I'm one of those insufferable hipster types.
quite honestly.
But no, that's true. Yeah, I do prefer. I like to sit in here and, you know, read my books and play a little jazz and blues music. You know,
you're reading your Didion, and you know
I am. I just got this collection.
I was just kidding, and I see it in front of me.
Tiffany will be so happy.
Oh God,
to hear
reading
that.
Your Didion while like in the background, southern trees bear a strange fruit.
Oh my God.
Don't eye roll at me, Ashley.
Right?
She's like, oh, you're so talented.
So talented, Joe.
What's new?
We need to get that should be a t-shirt for you. Just a picture of you like exactly like you are now, illustrated. Like a what do they call that? A oh shoot, starts with a V, I don't know.
Verisimilitude.
Yes, exactly.
Vivisection.
But just like a nice little drawing of you, and it just says so talented. That'd be it. Anyways, things have been going well. It was kind of a lazy day. I watched The Witches from 1990 or 91, 1991, something like that. Angelica Houston, lovely.
Lovely. Yeah. Of all the Houstons.
Of all the Houstons.
Danny, yes. Whitney, you know.
Yes, I do enjoy her. Because I was really, I wanted to, I went to see the new Addams Family movie.
And how was it?
You know, I really enjoyed it more than I thought I would. It
really?
Was, yeah, it was very darkly humorous. It was kind of funny because the theater, there weren't that many people in it, but Jeff and I kept laughing and nobody else was.
Were you?
So.
Did you partake in herbal refreshment?
No, I did sneak a little Bacardi in.
Oh.
You know, because we went at night, so it wasn't like.
Oh,
it was
you went at night?
I know, right? Yeah, we had it was totally crazy. We had like a thing where
you went to a children's movie out at night?
Yeah, I was like, let's go out. We'll have like a date. Well, because his mom gave us all kinds of gift cards. So we had like some ridiculous like $75 in like Red Lobster gift cards. And the only time we ever go there is when we gift card. So it's been like 2 years. So we've had them sitting there. So I'm like, let's go out. I want to go see the new Addams Family movie. That'll be fun. And I had looked online or on my app. So there was only like 3 seats sold. So I'm like, look, it looks empty.
Did you sit right next to those 3 people?
No, but I thought, well, it was funny because these people did come in and were in the same row as us, but the other side, nobody was on, but they still had to walk through us. Even though nobody was on the other side.
Another reason why you don't see movies at night.
I know. But anyway, so we were looking, and even while we're in line, I was still checking. I'm like, look, there's only 7 seats sold, and we'll sit right here.
Why didn't you sit like a row above or below them? Why did you sit in the same row?
Well, because we'd already settled. Because I told Jeffrey that. I was like, we could move, but it was like, ah, fuck it, you know. But anyways, that's not the point. The point is that it was a lovely little date night. So we went to the movie, and it was cute. It was nice. I mean, it was very visually, the look of them is kind of based on the old Chaz Adams, which I had out.
Oh, the comic.
Single panel cartoons from like The New Yorker and all of that. So aesthetically, it kind of looked like they based it on that, but it was very influenced by the 60s show.
Okay.
So, like, they had, like, Morticia has her plant, Cleopatra, that's man-eating. So there were lots more references to that film, or, I mean, to the television series, and then some of the comics. Because the 90s films were so influenced by that, too, you know, they based a lot of stuff and pulled a lot of imagery from the 60s show. I think it's kind of a good balance between all the mediums that the Addams Family have operated in. You know.
Okay.
Overall, story-wise, I mean, it was a typical kind of family thing. It's like, you know, the Addams brushing up against the quote-unquote normal world.
The normie world.
Yeah, and of course, it's just like a lot of those movies. It's like the fucked up ones are the, you know, the quote-unquote normal people. You know, that, you know what I mean? It was that kind of story.
Basically, we are the weirdos, mister. But like in a good way.
It's just like what I mean is like the champions of normalcy are more messed up than the people who are the weirdos.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean? It was that kind of storyline.
Because they actually have like this really tight-knit family as opposed to.
Yeah, exactly. They have a supportive family and all of that kind of thing. The Addams have always represented that kind of a, you know. There's supposed to be a twist on like the suburban typical family, nuclear family, but really in the end, the qualities that they have are often not better, but they perform those better than, you know what I mean? Not I expecting see. Their mm-hmm. kids, you know what I mean? All of that, the, you know, the love between Morticia and Gomez isn't based in like her servitude or his inherent superiority or, you know what I mean? Like I those see. Kinds of ideas about, you know, men and women and children and all of that. So blah, blah. Anyways, the point is that it was fun. You know, silly. It kind of also, I think the musical version, Wednesday like meets like a normie boy and marries him, right?
I've never.
Oh, I thought you had seen it.
No.
I've not seen it either. I just had listened to the music, but I think that's the storyline. And so this was kind of similar where like Wednesday wants to go out beyond like the house and wants to like make friends and, you know, see what the rest of the world is like. You know, whereas her parents are very afraid of that. Because in the story, they kind of code it with like, you know, they're sort of monsters and they've always been chased away places. Jeffrey, and it is kind of, you know, it's not lightly veiled. Lots of references to Judaism.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That so, they're Jewish?
That the it reads that way. Like, he was laughing a lot because afterwards we were driving home in the car and he's like, it's so funny because, like, you know, they're Jews. Like, that's kind of what they're coded as. Like, Pugsley has to perform this dance kind of thing with swords, and but first he has to read from this book, and it was just very coded,
like it's, a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, and even like there was like a line that Gomez says that the cadence of it echoed, like, you know, Baruch, you know what I mean,
that Baruch Atah Adonai.
Yeah, exactly, that sort of the sing-songiness of that. You know, so Jeffrey just talked a lot about how it kind of reminded him of that, of sort of like
of growing up Jewish.
They're like Eastern European Jews is what they're reading as, and so the normal
of course
folk
we're afraid
terrified
of them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, and run them out of places, and so they
like these Anglo-Saxons are just like no,
yeah, yeah. So which I thought was interesting. So, you know,
there's your Fright School Quick and Dirty
read of the Addams Family.
the Addams Family animated reboot.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. I mean, you know, I hope it gets a sequel. I love seeing weird stuff out there. We were kind of annoyed, though, because, you know, it's because we don't typically go to family-friendly movies, quote-unquote. You know, we don't go to a lot of movies that are geared towards children. We therefore are kind of left out of seeing previews for children.
Uh-huh.
So this had all kinds of cartoons attached to it and other like family and children animated stuff that kind of horrified us. Like, because there's like this new Trolls movie coming out, and it's like about, you know, six different types of music that each of the troll like families, I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking about? That Justin Timberlake troll movie?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're doing
a
sequel.
I don't know anything about it, but
no,
I know.
Yeah, me either.
Attached,
I have no idea. So all I got was this 2-3 minute trailer, you know, where it's like, you know, there are six types of trolls. There's like the country music trolls and the electronic trolls and blah, 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 all these different trolls. But then the bad one is the rock troll, and the rock and roll troll wants to like destroy all the other types of music. And I don't know. I was just really offended by like this sort of thing being sold to kids. Like, you know, this like tradition of like rock music being, I mean, obviously it's only from like 2 to 3 minutes. So who knows what the actual, but Jeff and I both sat there and we looked at each other like that. Well, that was some bullshit, you know, like it just seemed odd, but anyways.
But like pop music is being glorified or.
Well, yeah, just the others. But yeah, so the rock and roll troll. I mean, it was obviously in those kind of rock and roll stereotypes of like earrings and very punk looking. And, you know, she's playing the guitar and or they are playing the guitar. Actually, I'm not sure what genders the trolls were supposed to be. they read as a her.
Yes. Okay.
But so anyways, it just
coded female.
Yeah, it just annoyed me that it was like, you know, rock music's trying to destroy all the other types of music. And
well,
it was
rock
like
music's been
guy.
trying to destroy everything since the beginning.
Yeah,
right?
But it just, you know, all that satanic panic nonsense and things like that, you know, and it just,
I was going back as far as fucking Elvis. Like,
well, yeah, of course. You know, and so, and of course all the problematic roots of racism and all of that that's wrapped up in the hatred of rock music.
I see.
So it just bugged me. It just rubbed me the wrong way for 2 minutes. This trailer. I'm just like, I'm mad about this. But anyways, I recommend that.
Did you speak to the manager and ask for your money back? That you had to.
Yes, I burned the theater down to prove that rock music is not destructive. Anyways, I do recommend that people see it. I don't know if I recommend going to the theater. How about that?
How about we stream it, right?
Yeah. I had last year at the holidays, one of my coworkers gave me the AMC Black tickets. It's like you can just use them for free movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So she had given me some. Yeah, they were kind of neat. And they actually worked for a new release because it only came out on Friday. On October 11th, so this is right now, today, Monday, the whatever.
Yes.
so just this, that's fine. Yeah. But anyways, having difficulty here with the time. But anyway, so she had given us, so it was free to see. So I was like, you know, the whole night, the whole date was basically free. You know, it was all gift cards and...
Yeah, you guys make a killing in the gift cards.
I know, we do, because we really like them. Like, I know how some people get all, like, offended about gift cards. Like, that's always that conversation of, like, etiquette, you know? And we don't. I love that. Please give me gift cards so that I can choose what
Remember
I want.
Remember when we went to Starbucks before we saw Chelsea and you had, like, all those gift cards?
Yeah.
I was like, is he going to pull out more gift cards? Because that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I love a good gift card as well.
Yeah, I'm here for it. You know, I like gift cards of things even better. I like just plain old, like, money gift cards, you know? Just load up 50 bucks on a Visa card. I'll take it.
Cash money, bonds, you know?
And I believe that for other people, too. I love to give people gift cards. Choose what you want, you know? Because I'm hard to shop for. Look, we're sitting in a room full of shit I've purchased. You know, it's like, I don't have a problem buying the things that I want, you know? So I think I'm probably, like, Jeffrey has a hard time shopping for me. I have a hard time shopping for him. I'd rather, you know, find a few goofy things I give him every year and then give him gift cards. Figure out, you know, what you want.
Yeah.
So anyways, that was a long-winded way of saying that it was fun. It was, I recommend seeing it, but purchase tickets at your own risk to you know, paying full price to see it in the theater.
Maybe like a matinee or...
Yes, maybe. What about you?
Well, I saw Little Shop of Horrors in Pasadena Playhouse.
That's right, you did, with MJ Rodriguez and
then George Salazar and
Amber Riley
as Audrey 2.
The voice of Audrey 2.
Matt Wilkes as the dentist.
Right, because you said as the voice, right? Because you said they didn't pull that bullshit where they tried to have her on stage.
I know. No offense, Vicky Vox and like West End London Theater, but like,
I'm not here for that.
I'm not here for that. Also,
I want a puppet.
I'm your puppet. Yeah, it was great. It was like, I saw it. So like after when the James Corden performance came out from it, apparently like it was like record ticket sales that the Pasadena Playhouse had like ever performed had ever had.
Oh wow.
Now I think the show is nearly sold out, but it was such an interesting way to revive a musical because they definitely made it its own. They took they set it in modern time, so it's modern dress and the thing I love the most is how MJ Rodriguez played Audrey like very straight, like didn't have any affected voice, didn't have like it wasn't like cutesy. And I know that some people, and this is a fairly new concept to me, but some people have a problem. I've been made aware that there are people who have a really significant problem with how the show kind of plays up domestic battery for humor.
Yeah.
And while like I understand where they're coming from, I feel like because of the kind of cartoonish and heightened nature of the original production and of the film, it's like I never read it as humorous, but it's one of those things where it's like people can read it as humorous because of how they're portraying it. But she played it a very, very serious, and the tension between her and the doctor is like real. Like I was just like, wow. There were moments where I went, huh, that's a very interesting way to play that, because the way that Steve Martin, Ellen Green do it, it's, you know, it's this very, it's this caricature, and they're playing it like matter of fact, which just only adds to Seymour's when he finally makes the decision to kill the dentist and
yeah.
and
Orin.
How
Orin
oh yes Orin Scrivello DDS
DDS.
So yeah, it was. I mean, it was very good. Amber was the plant itself and the puppet was really like they were doing some really fun things. They had five puppeteers who at any given point were like one of the vines, and then like were actually the mouth, but it never like openly talked, and it was like this kind of beautiful. It was almost like this like tropical orchid looking thing, and not quite like the mouth that we see.
Yeah, the Venus flytrap.
The Venus. Yeah, yeah, it's not really a flytrap. It was like this beautiful looking orchid, and yeah, it was. I thought it was a very great adaptation, and it's so interesting because like this is going on now in Pasadena Playhouse. They have an off-Broadway, very intimate production going on in New York right now with Christian Borle as Orin Scrivello and Jonathan Groff as Seymour.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is more kind of traditional, quote unquote, in its portrayal.
Yeah, I can't remember. There was an article out somewhere. It was like A Tale of Two Little Shops, and it was examining the two very different productions going on right now.
Yeah, and it's just... In all honesty, like the production at Pasadena, I thought was just such a fresh take and update to it that, you know, it doesn't... Little Shop is Little Shop, and people will see it, but like I felt like you yeah. could get a little bit more. Plus, Mushnick was white in this one, and there is something to be said about, like, on national television, a romantic ballad that is about with two characters, both of color. One is a, like, queer, who is a gay man who is half Asian, half Latino, Latinx, and then you have a, like, trans woman of color as well. Like, it's just... One of
oh,
those,
you're talking about the Corden, James Corden
the
performance
James, the James
of
Corden
Suddenly Seymour.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm talking about that and seeing that and how, like, just that alone is, like, brilliant and a win for representation, so.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I really do want to see it, so I've got to figure it out because it's just... It sounds like a really good production. And I do like those ideas of kind of culling away some of like the campiness of it, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's campy in the right places. But like it's campy in the right places and it's definitely humorous in the right places.
Yeah.
But it's also very like interesting. It towards the end when it's all the different people who are offering Seymour something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Meekshell and Harriet.
The Meekshell and Harriet. And they're all being played by Matt Wilkes, who plays Orin Scrivello. And even like the woman, he comes out in like really shitty drag and like does all this stuff. And then the last person is kind of this like bro horticulturist that like it's just so interesting the different characterizations of all of those people. And
Yeah. Well, again, I think that's actually from the original script as well. That's actually in the libretto that Orin Scrivello, because that's after he's dead.
So that
actor comes back and plays all those characters. So a lot of times when you see the community theaters put it on, they get different actors to play it so they can put more people in the show or high school productions so they can put more people. But I think, yeah, the original libretto only calls for him to play like everybody else.
He did a very good job.
Yeah. I would really like to go see it. So I'm glad that you got the opportunity to see it and that it was really good. Cause yeah, I could see that cause it is such like a classic musical that, you know, people are very traditional with it, you know, and we're used to kind of seeing the same basic productions, the same characterizations, the same kind of ideas, even a lot of times the same plant design because it's expensive to build. So yeah. A lot of times here, you know, if one community place does it, then they just rent their puppets to everyone else so they can recoup the cost, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just easy to kind of see very, very similar productions over and over again. So I'm kind of excited by somebody doing something different with it. You know, modernizing it a little bit. So I do hope to go see it. I'm glad that you got the chance.
It's just good. I don't want to give away too much more because it was, if you do see it, I'm, I, I'm curious to see what you'll say, but it was very good. And I just keep thinking about Wendy too, because it's like, I really hope it's a plant. I really hope Amber Riley doesn't come out in like some god awful dress. God awful like plant Venus flytrap dress, and and she didn't, and she was also good, and like it just also like we talked about it, like it reinforces that the plant is female.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The plant, you know, is there to breed and spawn.
Yeah, I'd like to hear her voice. Like, you know, it's too bad. Like, obviously, you know, Suddenly Seymour, that's a big song, and it's great for those two to be on television. But I'd really like to see them promote it with her as well. I'd like to hear her singing.
I really kind of hope they release an album. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really do. And it's just the belty parts, you know, like, he's got your number now, and like, you know, life a crime. Like, it was just so, like, oh, I was like, Amber Riley, I remember.
Because yeah, you're a Gleek.
I'm a Gleek, yes. Yeah. Proud Gleek.
Proud Gleek, and that's all right. But I just didn't, I don't know that much about her, you know. Yeah. Like, I knew that she was from that show.
She played Effie in on the West End in a revival of Dreamgirls.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And I bet that was good, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, Little Shop of Horrors now playing at the Pasadena Playhouse. So if you're in Pasadena or want to come out.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we got going on? Carrie the Musical still going on at Onstage Playhouse in Chula Vista. So, you know, if you're around or near, I highly recommend seeing it. It was a good show. What else? We have coming up Wednesday, October 16th at 7 p.m. at Landmark Cinemas in Hillcrest. That's at 3965 Fifth Avenue. Thank you very much, 92103. We are co-hosting a showing of Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker along with... shoot, my brain just went. Film Out San Diego, obviously. Yes. Duh. Jesus, I'm messing this up. Film Out San Diego, Cinema Junkie, Horrible Imaginings Film Festival, Film Geeks SD, and then, of course, us, Fright School, are showing this very interesting film. Film.
It's been brought up before. Sam's brought it up on the show.
Yeah, 1981, about a... how do I want to say it? Actually, what was that? I saw a great description of it. I thought was actually kind of funny.
Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker.
Yeah, Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker. That's so fun to say. an obsessive and murderous woman tries to control her nephew, a 17-year-old basketball player.
Ah,
isn't that fun? But
is this presented by Lifetime?
Yes, exactly. So from our Facebook invite, with themes that vary from homophobia to homoeroticism to mental illness to even perhaps coming out of the closet, what better film to showcase than this underrated cult classic for Halloween? So it has an interesting reputation over the past few decades among LGBTQ and horror genre film lovers. So I think you should come out and see it and see us.
Yeah.
And see our friends and...
see it on the big screen.
See it. So look in the show notes below. We'll have a link to get tickets. So it'll be 2 days from now. So you want to make sure you go and come join us. It'll be fun.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's still early. You know, you've got plenty of time. You got to pack all the horror in that you can. You know?
Absolutely.
So yeah, we'll be doing that next. And what else? Man, I feel like we have so much going on lately. It's awesome. I feel very... What is it? Blessed?
Yes, we're booked, we're busy, and we're blessed.
Yeah, but we've got...
what are you kidding? Lots of fun stuff going. What would you know about being blessed?
Nothing. I'm too busy putting curses on folk. Hexes. A pox. A pox on your house, Joe, and see it happened.
Yeah, it did. What the fuck? What the fuck, Joshua?
Back. All right. Any other nonsense?
No, that's all the nonsense I got.
Nonsense.
The nonsense.
All right. You have to get caught up on RuPaul's Drag Race UK, because it's amazing.
Yes, apparently. It is a lot. Yeah. I texted my friend in that lives in Scotland. I was like, are you watching Drag Race UK? And he's like, yes. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. So yeah, you should definitely catch up on that. That way you'll have, you know, stuff to derail the conversation with. Look at that. You don't even have something, you know, to talk about to distract from the horror. You're converting, Joe.
I mean,
almost completely.
I felt myself getting better. I felt myself becoming normal again.
I know, that was so funny when you text me that. It's like, it's been so long since I've
watched a horror. I watched Zombieland my own. Oh, I showed my mom A Quiet Place.
Yes.
And
how'd that go?
She thought that was a lot. I was like, and she's like, what about Hereditary? I'm like, no. Oh, if you thought that A Quiet Place was a lot.
Yeah, save that for Mother's Day.
You're not ready for Hereditary.
Save that for Mother's Day with her. That'll be
when
nice.
She stepped on the nail, she went, ah!
I love that.
Yeah. And then I watched Zombieland because I realized that I had never seen the original Zombieland. So.
What'd you think?
I love Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah.
I love him and, you know.
I love Emma Stone.
Well, there you go. One for you, one for me.
Yeah. I enjoy it. I mean, I'm sad you watched it without me, I will say, because that was one of those that I was kind of also keeping on the back burner for like a really bad, scary movie that I could...
That you could show me.
That
like,
I could show that to kind of cool the burn.
No, the next one we're watching is Can't Hardly Wait. Like, that's what we're watching after the next one. After Arachnophobia.
Right. After Arachnophobia. We'll do that. All right, then. Well, we'll take a short break and we'll be back to discuss 1931's Frankenstein.
That's why I don't have sex. It's not because of my face or my general attitude towards human beings. The thing is that they don't refer to any of these things as murders, which is the most amazing part. It's always referred to as a disappearance. There's fucking blood filling the back of a truck.
That was certainly nice of me, wasn't it, huh?
Same set as Castle.
What? Is that really?
No, but I would believe it, actually. That wouldn't shock me. I can't imagine that there's a ton of castles that Charles Band has at his disposal.
That frog is going to bang Roddy Piper.
Nope, she's just one horny toad.
Justin Lund just screamed that he's a fucking walrus for so long.
He keeps yelling cuckoo-ca-choo and shit. It's weird.
Join me and Matt as we discuss some of the worst of horror every week on the Horror Movie Night podcast. Listen at hmnpodcast.com.
All right, welcome back. I'm very excited that we're doing this movie because we haven't done a universal monster classic in a while.
Well, Wolfman.
That's true, but it's been a while.
Well, yes, I guess it's been a while. Regardless.
Yeah, but over the time, over the 4 or so years, our anniversary is coming up, right? 4 years?
Yes, 4 years, Josh.
4 years, that's amazing.
Don't forget our anniversary.
It's coming up. But over that time, we haven't done a ton of classic...
Universal Monsters.
Like foundational kind of horror stuff. Like this is considered... This is actually considered one of, like, you know, a great film in general. Anyway, so yes, 1931, American classic, Frankenstein, from Universal Pictures, directed by James Whale.
It was it's a Carl Lamely picture, right?
Produced by,
who was it again? Carl Lamely? I mean, you couldn't tell, his name was all over it.
I know, it's so
I didn't
funny.
Even, I thought he directed it until you said something.
Yeah, James Whale directed it, but you're right, I mean, just in that opening title, like, card. Yes. It was like Carl Emily production of a Carl Emily film produced by Carl Emily. It's like, okay, dude, we did not need.
We get it.
Yeah. He just wanted to make sure if it was a big hit, he got all the credit, which it was. It was a big hit. It went over well. Based on Mary Shelley's 1818 novel, Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. I think we all know the story, but real quick, in the book, it is Victor Frankenstein.
It is Victor in the book.
Henry here. Henry Frankenstein builds himself a man for nefarious purposes. No, just to prove he can do it.
Yes, to play God.
To play God. And, you know, monster runs amok. Things happen.
And then, you know, what happens when you play God?
Exactly. Who is the real monster?
Yes.
Joe, What'd you think? What were your thoughts?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think of the Universal monsters that we've watched so far, I like this one the best.
Yeah.
So far, you know, I've not watched The Creature. I've not watched a lot of things.
Yeah.
So.
Pourquoi? Why is this one the best? Why'd you like it?
I liked it because it moved. It moved really well. I enjoyed the cinematography of it.
Yeah. And
I thought it. I was able to. It held my attention a lot more than the other ones. I mean, it's also not terribly misogynistic. It's the Wolf Man. but yeah, like it was good. It was good. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I understand now all of the references to things in other, you know, in other films and other television shows that reference Frankenstein. Like when he, you know, drowns that little girl.
You know, he's just trying to throw pretty things in the water.
Because that's apparently what you do, right?
That's what he understood.
Yes. And then I said is like you were telling me, like, he's just throwing pretty things in the water. I'm like, oh, well, you'll never get there. Shake of head.
Stop it.
Stop it.
That's fine with me. I don't want to be drowned by Boris Karloff. Yeah, there you go. You can.
Yes, I have our Ouija board clack fan.
There we go. From Monster Posse.
Yes.
Bing.
Woo.
Yeah. Anyways, I agree.
Wonderful.
I really like Frankenstein. It had been a long time since I had rewatched it. I forgot how like theatrical it is.
Yes, it is. And I think I appreciated that because yeah. I also liked that like we could really see their faces. Like it wasn't about like they weren't afraid of like you know, a medium shot or like a tight close up of people's faces and you know, it's and not for nothing. It takes place in vague Europe again,
right? It's that famous locale in so many of these early pictures.
I was like,
early
why is Henry Frankenstein's accent thicker than his father's?
Yeah,
and he had that like kind of like whistle tone when he was talking. So he had like the heat, like when he's just like breathing or whatever in his mouth. I was like, this, I cannot abide.
I just like how they talk in general. Like it kind of reminds me again of that Atlantic kind of, you know.
Now,
yeah. Yeah, we have to go here. Where are my hens?
Yes.
All right, so where to begin with Frankenstein? So first of all, this was made in 1931, the same year as Dracula.
Yes.
But I do think it is a far superior movie.
Yeah.
Just
in the film quality, too.
Yeah, I think the film quality is good, I think, or is better. And I think the story, just it kind of, it moves, you know, much better. When we talked about Dracula, we talked a lot about, like, the Great Depression and, you know, and... you know, vampires kind of being in that, but I don't see this movie as kind of moving in that same way. You know,
It's not commenting on the current time.
Outside of the fact that you do sort of have, I mean, still kind of that aristocratic, you know, versus like the peasant. You know, we talked a little bit about that with like, you know, Henry and Elizabeth's wedding is like this big event that like the whole town is like rallying around. I mean, there are definitely discussions there that could be had probably about, you know, the rich and the poor, but it's not as obvious, I feel, in this movie.
They're not being preyed upon by a like wealthy, like immigrant.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's all directed at an other, but you know what, and that was the interesting thing too, when like when the father comes and he's in that, you know, he's catatonic because of his dead daughter, and they all kind of come and like, oh, we're gonna go find the monster,
right? Yeah, when that the little girl that the monster drowns,
yes,
on accident. Yeah, it's a great, that's a, that catalyst for the mob,
but like the mob is being led by Henry Frankenstein.
Yes.
And he's the one who created the damn thing.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
they
yes.
don't, I think the dramatic irony of it is that they don't know that. Like, they don't know that he's responsible.
Right.
Because, like, in In Van Helsing, in the Van Helsing, the first scene is like Frankenstein making the monster in the windmill, and the villagers are coming because they identify Frankenstein as the monster playing God, like
right.
As the monster playing God, creating his own monster, and I feel like in this film, they're coming after the monster because he's the one who drowned her, but not the person who is directly responsible for creating him. And there's like, and right. there's obviously the guilt and all of that associated with. But again, wealth and whiteness is protecting him.
Right. Well, and that's the whole thing. So obviously one of the easiest, or not easiest, but probably one of the most obvious reads of Frankenstein, the novel, the media that's followed, is that sort of balance, or that fight between religion and science.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's probably, a very shocking thing about this film. There was, so it's pre-code, but obviously there's lots of controversy. Like, there's a whole thing where Victor, the friend in this, that was a whole fun conversation.
I know, we were trying to figure out who is the Victor that Elizabeth is talking to, because it's not her fiancé.
And then it was like, oh, but they changed his name to Henry. But anyway, so Victor says, Henry, in the name of God. And Henry says, in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God. Mm-hmm. So that was very...
That, I bet, was horrifying.
Like blasphemy, you know, yeah. to people in the 30s. In fact, Kansas, it says here, the regarding pre-code era scenes and censorship history, Kansas requested cutting 32 scenes, which would just basically cut the movie in half.
Yeah.
It was so upsetting to people, you know, this idea of a man playing God.
Yeah, of basically, like, the grave robbing into, you know, chopping him up. And I think that was a disturbing revelation in the film, where he says to the professor, like, oh, this man was never alive. I made him.
Yeah, I put Dr. him, Waldman.
Yes, I put him together. And I was like, ooh, yeah, that is like, oh, that's right. Because he's like made from the bodies of other dead men who were like paupers and, you know, at the gallows. And he's not made from good stock.
Well, yeah, he's just digging up the freshest he can find.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, so that, I think, is obviously, yeah, the kind of the obvious conversation to have around Frankenstein is, you know, our science's role.
Yeah, and that was going on at the time that when Shelley wrote it, like in that Victorian era literature,
because
you have this, you have Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, those are the questions that are coming out of that time, and what is our place, and you know, it's always that thing of like, just because we can, should we?
Right. Yes, exactly. And so it kind of makes it interesting, because it echoes now into like modern day with like the conversation we're having around like artificial intelligence and like mm-hmm. Silicon Valley mm-hmm. and
nanotechnology.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and you have this kind of fight amongst like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, about whether robots are here to help or hurt us.
Exactly, yes.
So, yeah, I think that it kind of remains so... Frankenstein still is a story that is interesting to us because we're still having those conversations about, you know, where science... what science's role is in our lives, and where does it overstep? You know, I think of the conversation not only around like artificial intelligence and, you know, spyware and, you know, this whole thing about, you know, facial recognition and, you know, how much we're being watched, but, you know, also like stem cell research and, you know, obviously religious people get very upset about that and have pushed back. And so a lot, you know, some of the funding and all of that has been shut down, but we have seen real benefits, you know, to using stem cells.
Yeah.
So I just think, it remains very relevant in that way, with just that relationship between science and nature and spirituality, for people who have that religion, for people who have that.
Yeah. I thinking about it in this moment, having this conversation, it's also the thing about his pursuit is that it's entirely ego driven. It doesn't seem like mm-hmm. it's driven by anything other than he wants to know what it's like to create life. He wants to know what it's like to destroy life, but then he wants to know what it's like to create life and from nothing. Like, it's not enough to resurrect somebody that was alive. It's about creating new life entirely, but it seems completely ego driven. Unlike, like, let's say, The Fly, where in The Fly, his purpose is like to basically, like, it's an environmental purpose, and it's all about that. I feel like it's one of those things where it's like it's the hubris of like this thirst for knowledge,
right?
You know, Chidi from Midsommar, like, who is like going into the temple to copy these things because he's thirsting for knowledge, and it's eventually his own undoing,
right?
Mm-hmm. And I it's so fascinating to me because it's like I am a person who is naturally curious and does like answers, but I feel like horror is constantly telling me that maybe there's just some things you're not meant to know.
Right, yeah, horror definitely can play that role of asking that question, where we can experiment, you know, with these sorts of ideas in horror.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but you know, they can be so dangerous. Because when Mary Shelley published this, she didn't even have her name on it because she was worried. She was worried the children that she had that were still alive at that time. Because, man, I don't know if you've read much about Mary Shelley, but wow. lots of tragedy with her miscarriages and babies dying early, and she just had a lot of grief.
I mean, that could definitely inform why she would want to write a story about someone who is like creating life.
Yeah, I think to some extent, absolutely. But it's just that sort of, what you're saying, like the
hubris, the cautionary tale of it.
Yes. But anyways, before I got off track there, this idea that, so when she published it, she didn't put her name on it because one, she worried, like she thought maybe people would try to take her kids from her, but she also, there was this thing about, avoiding, so there's this article, The Strange and Twisted Life of Frankenstein, from The New Yorker. It was published I think 2018.
And the 200 years, right?
Yeah, it's on, yeah, exactly. I can't find where the publication date was, but they have this thing here where it says that, she participated in this. So Frankenstein is also kind of wrapped up in who wrote it, you know, those kind of same problems where, people say she had lots of help from other people to write it. Yep. And that this, so this is from the paper, this enduring condescension, the idea of the author as a vessel for the ideas of other people, a fiction in which the author participated so as to avoid the scandal of her own brain. Because the ideas in it and the things that she's putting forth and talking about just were so scandalous. You know, that of man creating life, of thinking that he could be God, you know, was just absolutely blasphemous, to the people when it was released.
The idea that he could create from nothing something.
Yeah, but I think sometimes that's kind of why, you know, besides the fact that Mary Shelley wrote it, or, you know, I tend to think that she did. I think she was very well educated. She read a lot. We have her, there are diaries that she kept where she talked about reading all these different philosophers and these different books, and, you know, and that's reflected in the writing. Because the creature in the book, in the novel, is intelligent. It teaches itself to read. It stumbles upon some of the books that she herself had read, and it reads them, and it, you know, it talks. It's very, very different from the lumbering Boris Karloff, you know, what we've come to know as like the Frankenstein monster. You know, in the book, it's way more intelligent. So it's like, I think it reflects a lot of her own background, you know, like in education, what she was reading, which I think is interesting. So because she wrote it, and sometimes it gets credited, Frankenstein gets credited as the first actual like science fiction book written by the gothic female.
Yeah.
And so it can get like a feminist reading as well, because Victor Frankenstein, Henry Frankenstein, I guess if we go back to just reading, you know, the analyzing the film.
Yeah.
He's trying to create life not only as God, but in the absence of woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's like another thing where he's usurping God and womankind to completely leave her out, you know, of the creation of life. So if he's able to do this and then teach others to do it, what purpose does woman hold now?
But woman would still, like, okay, so on that conceit, right? So, like, woman still has a place because he is not, it's one thing if, like, he energized a primordial ooze that created life from, you know, slime. It's another thing when you're stringing dead bodies together, dead bodies that are that were all made from, that had come from a womb.
Right.
So, yeah. Like, woman still plays a part, maybe not a direct part in the creation of these abominations, but still it's necessary to have the natural process in order to have the unnatural process.
Yeah.
In order to have that perversion, right?
I agree, but I think it's the idea of that continuing. Like when they talk about artificial wombs or like ways to create life outside of
like women.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's fascinating.
Changing that relationship. Like I said, I mean, no, I don't think that is possible, you know, and obviously, you know, it's not, what do you want to say? I don't know. I just don't know if, I don't know what I think when it comes to that, like that conversation about, because I don't think that women should exist solely to have children either. So it's like, I think that artificial wombs aren't necessarily a bad thing.
But as a way to like reinforce,
but not
patriarchy.
Well, exactly, not in that way. But if it was like something where it's like, you know, people want to have children and they don't want to do it themselves, I don't know. That's kind of an interesting idea. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like not to make women obsolete, but for people who, I don't know, kind of a we're off into a strange territory now.
Yeah.
It's just that sort of conversation, I think in sci-fi is really interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Just talking about creating life without, you know, the quote unquote natural order of it, you know, of having a woman with a womb.
But also like on that subject, right? So like he's comparing himself to God when, you know, it's also necessarily, it necessarily admits that the natural way, the way that God intended is through a woman.
Right.
Right. So it's just like, so it includes women in the process. I mean, at that point, you're reducing them to basically like this incubation. This
right. Well, yeah, exactly. And that's why it's like, it's kind of an interesting Rubik's Cube to kind of turn around in your mind where it's like, you know, I don't think women should be, you know, trapped into having babies unless they want to, by all means have babies, you know, but it's like.
But then how do we still have, how do we propagate a population and well, I mean, I'm just thinking about Blown Away. So Blown Away, the Netflix show with the glass blowers.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the challenges was like create a robot out of glass.
Yeah.
And she creates an artificial womb because it's a commentary on allowing men to experience what it would also be like to be the active participant in childbirth.
Oh, yeah.
And so like from that thing, it's like at that point, it's like it's not creating an obsolescence for women, but it's like a radical empathy that they're experiencing, because it's like it's a way to have a distribution of labor, you know, not to put a pun on it.
Right.
So maybe but again, like it's all about intentions. And I think that's what it comes down to with anything science fiction where you're talking about, oh, this, if we do this, it's potentially bad. Because, like, again, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right.
So it all is, we can intend for this thing to happen. I mean, the whole reason we have the Nobel Prize is because a man felt guilty that his invention was being used to kill hundreds of thousands of millions of people. So,
right.
It's, again, it's about intention and the danger of an idea where we can see, like, those are my favorite parts in sci-fi. It's like, we can see how this, in this particular context, in this particular person's mind, can reinforce and be a benefit to humanity. But we can also see, like, how if we just tweak it just this little bit, it's now in, like, it now is a force for destruction. And that line between a helpful creative force and a destructive, like apocalyptic destructive force is very thin.
Yeah, and you wonder what Frankenstein, meaning Victor Frankenstein's intention really was outside of, like, so this this whole story, at least film-wise, is just he wants to do it to say that he can.
Yeah.
So we don't know really after that, you know, once you create this life and you have it, what purpose?
What is it for?
Yeah.
Why?
What is it for? Especially because he essentially abandons it immediately.
Yes.
You know, and it, especially in, like, the novel, it's like he's so horrified by what he's created that he just leaves it and runs away.
Yeah.
You know, so abandoning any sort of, you know, and that could be a comment, obviously, on, like, men lacking the maternal instinct, you know, to care for something that doesn't understand what's happening yet.
It could be an existential.
He doesn't have that.
Yeah. I mean, it could be an existential comment on how God is ashamed of us and how destructive mm-hmm. we've become.
Yeah. That concept of, like, deism, of just abandoning what has been made, left to its own devices. You know, so it's very tragic. So kind of turns us a little bit to, you know, a conversation on the monster itself, himself, their self.
Themselves.
Themselves.
Made from multiple people, right?
Right. It's so, again, you know, I'm trying to keep in mind the conversation we had with Michael Verratti of not always seeing, like, our queer selves in the monster.
I know.
But this is so different. I think this is one of those readings where that does hold true with Frankenstein, because with Frankenstein's monster, because he is an innocent in it, you know, like, he's brought into the world, he's very confused, he's made up of these, you know, disparate parts, and quote unquote, what it's been labeled as an abnormal brain, you know, in his skull, being, you know, kind of brought in, and he's very confused, and, you know, this father figure rejects him and, you know, kicks him out, pushes him out into the world completely unprepared, you know, into a society that is not built
for him.
For him. You know, so it's very tragic. You know, it's a very, very tragic story. And that's why the novel is so good, because you get so much of, like, you know, the creature itself talks a lot and has its own words and finds the notes from its father and realizes, like, you know, what it is. And it's so angry at him for creating him and abandoning him and, you know, all of that. So it's like, it's very easy, I think, to get that sort of queer reading, you know, from this.
Yeah. And then you were also saying that the director was openly gay as well.
Yes, was openly gay. Odd, very, very odd for the 20s and 30s. We'll eventually watch Bride of Frankenstein, which gets an even more often credited with queer readings. But I still think that this, like, or otherness in general, like, it doesn't even have to necessarily be, like, LGBTQ queerness. Just as in, you know, whatever's considered non-normative, you know, because the creature, it's confused, and, you know, it doesn't have a language yet, you know. And so I was thinking, because I was reading this paper about, it was particular to the LGBTQ experience of being in school and, you know, your classmates or your, you know, the other people in the school have boyfriends and girlfriends, and things are normalized in society for their experience. So you're here kind of alone. There's a real sense of loneliness to that experience when you can't openly say, maybe that's shifting, but obviously when I was in high school and before that, you know, you can't be open with yourself. So you don't even know who else might actually be out there like you, you know, so society is just not constructed for you, you know, it's easy to feel, you know, I think it's easy to see that in the monster here.
Have you watched Van Helsing?
No.
We might have to watch it, because the monster speaks in Van Helsing.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah. Like it's interesting, because it's like, I mean, it's Hugh Jackman. So I'm surprised you've not watched it.
He plays Helsing.
He plays Van Helsing.
Van Helsing, yeah.
But like, what they do is they incorporate the mythologies of Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, and the werewolf, the wolfman. Okay. So they incorporate those three stories, mythologies, into one story of, you know, with Van Helsing. And it's interesting because, like, the monster kind of brings these things up. Like, he has these, he speaks and has these conversations about it. And because he is, like, made from seven men, but he is alive and is sentient and knows himself, does that mean that because of how he came into the world, now he must die?
Mm.
Like, it's interesting. And I say that, like, knowing that this was completely made, that, like, the movie was completely made as just kind of, like, you know, a fun action-y romp. But it's interesting to kind of see that.
Yeah, that reading when the creature can speak.
When the creature can speak. And that's the thing, is that, like, now hearing what you're saying about the novel, watching the original 1931 film, all of that, it's very interesting to kind of put that into context. I actually really like the movie Van Helsing. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I don't know why I skipped it. I feel like maybe I just wasn't, I don't know, for whatever reason I wasn't drawn to it. But you've brought it up a few times throughout the, you know.
It's one of the few, like, horror, I guess, quote-unquote thing. And the thing is that I would never consider it horror. I just thought it was like
kind of an
action, like, comic booky type film.
Yeah.
Also, for what it's worth, Van Helsing is an agent of the Catholic Church. So, you know, there's all of that that goes into it, too.
Yeah, you kind of brought that up a few times in watching this.
Well, it was just interesting because, like, the very first scene is, like, this funeral scene. And it kind of reads as, like, Eastern Europe or, like, this European Roma tradition. And then you have this, like, and it's like, it looks very Catholic, like the rites that are being administered on this are very Catholic. And I'm just like, huh, like, there's no better way to kind of instill, like, a quote unquote, like, immigrant, non-waspy, like, type of mentality than to have it be like Catholicism. Because for a long time, people were just, you know, the Anglo-Saxon Protestant kind of white Christians of America saw, you know, Catholicism as this, like, immigrant religion shrouded in mystery, popery. And, you know, I just go back to what Daniel Day-Lewis says to in Gangs of New York. It's like, your popery and your, you know, cannibalism and all that stuff. So it's fascinating to see how that was, like, used to, like, show we are not in America.
Yeah. Well, especially in the 30s.
Yeah.
I think that's a very interesting reading, because it's so different now, where Catholicism, I mean, it's kind of like the monarchy. Like, Americans are really invested in the Pope and what the Pope is doing and what the Pope has to say.
Yeah. Even, like, non-Catholics are very invested in what the Pope is saying.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting to me, because, like, I always, Jeffrey and I have kind of gone back and forth on that of, like, you know, because he's very, you know, he likes political science. He's very into what the monarchy is doing.
And he is, I mean, he's technically a head of state, so.
Yeah, so I get it, but it's also, it's like, you know, people share things on Facebook where, oh, the Pope has declared blah, blah about LGBT rights or about women or about, and I'm like, I don't give two fucks what the Pope has to say on this matter. Like, I don't care, you know, but it's interesting that, you know, same thing, like, I don't care about the royal wedding. You know,
yeah,
like, no, I'm not going to watch that. Like, yeah. I don't care. But like people, like some people here are like hardcore into it, like in America, you know, which
I find, the royal wedding and the Pope.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I find very fascinating. I mean, the Pope, I'm not surprised by because Catholicism is so.
And it's a belief. So it's like, you know, when the head of over 1 billion people who, you know, says that, oh, this thing that we've been telling you for 2,000 years is awful, it's actually pretty good, or, you know, this thing that we've been doing that's not so great, hey, let's stop doing it, let's do something else. Like, when he says that, mm-hmm. he is like, you know...
Yeah, no. Absolutely. I do care about the influence that the Pope has, but his opinions on how gay people should be or how women should behave, like, I'm not particularly interested in for myself. But obviously, you're right. It's very powerful for some people, and they take it very seriously, you know, his decrees, obviously, like any major religious figure.
And especially because, like, this is a person who is, like, God's divine representative on earth, that, like, when he speaks ex cathedra, which means, like, when he speaks from the chair of Peter, he is in that moment infallible.
Right. Like, yeah.
Which, you know.
It's just interesting to tie that to kind of how that's changed here in America from, like, when this film was made and what you're saying about, you know, the othering of the people here via Catholicism. Yeah.
And again, it's like, it's that vague Europe where it's just like, we know that it's not supposed to be in America, like, it's supposed to be somewhere else.
Right.
One thing I want to bring up is the trigger warning.
Oh, right at the beginning. This film may terrify you. Actually, what is it?
I wanted him to say, like, and if you don't like what you're seeing, well, too bad, we got your money.
Yeah, he...
No refunds!
So, who is it? It's Edward Van Sloan.
Ooh, Van Sloan.
Yes, he was an American film character actor. So he was in several Universal horror films here. So comes out just to warn everybody that it's a story of a man of science who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning upon God. And then goes on to say that it might even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now's your chance to, well, we warned you. I thought it was very, you know, they just wanted, you know, to make sure that people knew what they were getting into, especially because it did. I mean, it was very controversial, some of these thoughts being put forth in this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, they had such a, you know, a big hit with Dracula. And I think that Universal, you know, who had lost a lot of money and were not doing well, were really invested in, or were really... enthused by Dracula.
Yeah,
or
and
by,
I mean, like, the, and again, like, let's just go back to the, like, science fiction-y roots of the text, right?
Right.
So, like, less inclined for, less likely for a blood-sucking immortal than it is for potentially someone in the name of, like, science to resurrect the dead. I mean... like, it's less likely Dracula than it is more likely the danger of what we are proposing, that this man is going to try and play God. At the very least, it's like he is going to defile graves. Like, right. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, at the very least, he's committed grave robbery and he's defiled graves. So, you know, not for nothing.
Of warning people.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, you're going to see a guy who basically, like, you know, cut another man from the gallows and then, like, is going to, like, eventually sew all these people together.
Right. Yeah, because I wonder how many people were familiar with the novel. I mean, I'm sure there were quite a few that would have known.
Enough to probably...
Enough to
make the film, at least.
Yeah, because at this time, the novel was already over 100 years old. So I imagine that, you know, people had read it or were familiar. But, I mean, it is so radically different. Oh, that's what I was going to ask you, actually. I was curious what your thoughts on why do you think they simplify the monster so much here?
I feel like it would have been too jarring to give him... any agency. That if he's just, again, like you say with zombie movies, it's like when they're just pure need, pure id, driven only by, like, not even knowing what the motivations are, that's where it gets terrifying. And to add that kind of depth, I don't think at that time they were interested in adding any depth to a monster and nuance. Yeah. Because again, like in our modern filmmaking age, we're concerned with that depth and that nuance. And it's right. Like, okay, you are an abomination, but it's obvious to us that you also feel and are sentient and are very self-aware. So it's like, does that mean that because of all of that, you deserve to live? And if you have something that's communicating needs and all of that, it's less likely for us to vilify the monster.
Yeah. It's just interesting because this film, I think, and maybe it's just my own, like with The Fly. Other movies where I find, because it still is very tragic. Like, I'm curious about people who did see the film back in the 30s and were like terrified by Frankenstein's monster. But also, I mean, he's still very sad, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's tragic.
It is very sad because, like, this creature did not ask to be created, but here it is, and no one's dealing with it. I mean, again, like what you said, like, no one's dealing with it. And then the moment that he does something that he thinks is the thing to do, he's vilified for it, but he didn't know. Like, he didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's interesting. I think there's so much that you can put in, you know, so many readings that you can put on the monster, because it's like, it's also kind of like representative of just all of us in general. Like, you know, like humans, we are born of whatever you want to think, you know, cosmic accident or intelligent design. Either way, none of us asked to be here. You know, we're born, we're brought up, we're conditioned by the society we're in to behave the way that we do. You know, so I think there's, you know, kind of that sort of reading as well, for me at least. And watching it again today, I'd written down that I felt like in some way the monster is like enduring this society and trying to maneuver in it when there's so much against that happening.
Yeah, which is a very queer way to read the monster.
Yeah, I guess in some sense. But I did like your point about that, about kind of stripping away all of that.
You strip away the humanity.
Yeah, the humanity.
It's easier for us to vilify the monster and want it dead and to see it as a monster if it doesn't speak and we don't give it a voice. I mean, again, as is with queerness, right?
Right.
It's like, it's very easy for us if all we think is like, if they don't talk and we don't give them agency and we just, you know, we other them in that way and we don't get to know them. It's easier to do that. It's easier to, you know, light the windmill on fire and feel that we are doing what we need to do to be safe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Same with like conversations of race and all of that. You know, we can avoid having deeper talks about it if you vilify the person trying to talk about their experience.
Yeah, exactly.
it's still such an interesting film. And again, I think that also echoes kind of a little bit about what we were talking about earlier with like Silicon Valley and artificial intelligence and robots, you know, as we kind of continue down this path, you know.
That's literally creating life where it exists. Well,
yeah, absolutely. And it has the ability there's the possibility there of consciousness, of sentience, you know, in a robot. You know, we're going to have to, I think, battle these questions.
Yeah.
So even though she wrote this novel in 1818,
200 years ago,
thinking about these issues, you know, thinking about human dabbling, you know, in science, in God, we're here still doing that. You know, we're here now. I mean, they had that robot come on television with Jimmy Kimmel or whoever it was, or no, the other guy, the one that used to be on SNL.
Jimmy Fallon.
all these Jimmys, James, all of them that are taking up residence in late night. You know, but he's like having this conversation with this robot. And yeah, there is some human, you know, behind the scenes stuff probably going on as well. But it just made me think, like, we're probably not that far from having
the singularity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and then seeing, you know, us using robots to start doing tasks or having, I mean, we are seeing that already, but I mean these sort of android.
Yeah. Type. Where there's some sort of sentience. And, yeah. And I mean, again, this is the enduring part of like the 200 year legacy of Frankenstein. It's that these conversations are still being had today.
Yeah. Just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I do really like this movie. I am actually a big fan, too, of Kenneth Branagh's, or Branagh's, however you say his name.
Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein Count, like, 94 with Robert De Niro. I like that. It's got a lot of mixed reviews, but I do recommend a watch if you haven't seen it, just because it is a lot more faithful to the novel, kind of that American, or I mean,
did that come
Gothic.
Out around the after Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Because yeah, it's been.
Well, like, because it's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Bram Stoker's Dracula, like, it's a little parallel.
Maybe, yeah. Might have been an attempt there at kind of
some sort of parallelism.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But I do remember seeing the movie when it came out and really liking it as a kid. And Helena Bonham Carter's in it. And, like I said, Robert De Niro. Kenneth plays Victor Frankenstein along with directing it. So I enjoy it, but I know it has like mixed reviews. I will take this opportunity also to once again plug Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus, the 200th anniversary edition, illustrated by David Plunkard. We talked about it on a past episode.
Yes, beautifully illuminated.
It is. It's really, really gorgeous. And apparently there's another, which I really want to order because I need another version of the novel.
Exactly.
There's a 200th anniversary edition that's annotated. It's got like over 1,000 notes that help kind of better understand the world that Mary Shelley was inhabiting at the time. It also has like 200 plus illustrations of all kinds of different things. So mm-hmm. That's out there as well. I can't remember who annotated it. He's done some others. He did like the Sherlock Holmes annotated edition. And another one. Oh, here it is. The new annotated Frankenstein. By, what was his name? Obviously edited, Leslie S. Klinger. But who's the guy that did it?
Anyways, we'll have to put that in the show notes.
Yeah. Well, I'll link both of those in the show notes because they're. I want to pick that up because it does look really interesting. I have the annotated Alice, which is great. Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, yeah.
It's fantastic. So I really enjoy annotated books, especially like from these time frames because we've changed a lot. Like the world is so different in so many ways that is really fascinating to kind of read some of the notes or when they make specific references. It's kind of cool to be able to.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So I recommend both of those. Also recommend The Strange and Twisted Life of Frankenstein, again, from The New Yorker. It's a kind of a cool article. There was so much in it. It's mostly about the novel, though. So
we'll have to make sure that a link of some sort is in the show notes.
Yes, there will be, because I do recommend a read of it if you enjoy Frankenstein, the novel or this film, you know, because there are some... Obviously, parallels.
There's some parallels, yes. Victor versus Henry, though.
Right. I don't know. That's such a strange thing. And why'd they name the friend Victor?
Yeah.
Instead of Henry and Henry Victor. So would it just... I don't know. That's weird to me.
Victor, Henry, who cares?
Yeah, who knows? I have no idea what was happening there. Anyways, all right. So, yay. That's Frankenstein under our belt.
Awesome. Great. I did really enjoy it.
Yes. It's a fun movie. And again, it's fast. It's like 71 minutes. So just over an hour and beautiful little piece of cinematography. And like I said, it's considered one of the greatest, one of the great films.
Awesome.
So it's a nice
addition.
Date night movie.
Late night, date night.
All right, Joe. Well, sleep well. Hope that you have no nightmares of
the singularity and robots taking over.
All righty. Well, good night.
Good night. Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.